as the train approached the station, and had had a very sheltered upbringing. I learned more about love and sex in that 10 weeks, watching your series on television, than I had learned in my whole life before. I just wanted to thank you for that program. Francesca accepted the compliments gracefully. She was accustomed to being recognized when she was in public. When the train stopped and she descended onto the platform, Francesca smiled again at the young man and his date. Reggie Wilson offered to carry her camera equipment as they walked toward the people mover that would take them to the hotel. "Does it ever bother you?" he asked. She looked at him quizzically. "All the attention, being a public figure," he added in explanation. "No," she answered. "Of course not." She smiled to herself. "Even after 6 months, this man does not understand me. Maybe he's too engrossed with himself to figure out that some women are as ambitious as men." "I knew that your 2 television series had been popular," Reggie was saying, "before I met you during the personnel screening exercises. But I had no idea that it would be impossible to go out to a restaurant or be seen in a public place without running into one of your fans." Reggie continued to chat as the people mover eased out of the train station and into the shopping center. Near the track at one end of the enclosed mall, a large group of people were milling around outside a theater. The marquee proclaimed that the production inside was In Any Weather by the American playwright Lindsay Olsen. "Did you ever see that play?" Reggie idly asked Francesca. "I saw the movie when it first came out," he continued without waiting for her to answer, "about 5 years ago. Helen Cordill and Jeremy Temple, before she was really big. It was a strange story, about 2 people who had to share a hotel room during a snowstorm in Chicago. They're both married. They fall in love while talking about their failed expectations. As I said, it was a weird play." Francesca was not listening. A boy who reminded her of her cousin Roberto had climbed into the car just in front of them at the first stop in the shopping center. His skin and hair were dark, his facial features handsomely chiseled. "How long has it been since I have seen Roberto?" she wondered. "Must be 3 years now." It was down in Positano with his wife, Maria. Francesca sighed and remembered earlier days, from long ago. She could see herself laughing and running on the streets of Orvieto. She was 9 or 10, still innocent and unspoiled. Roberto was 14. They were playing with a soccer ball in the piazza in front of Il Duomo. She had loved to tease her cousin. He was so gentle, so unaffected. Roberto was the only good thing from her childhood. The people mover stopped outside the hotel. Reggie was looking at her with a fixed stare. Francesca realized that he had just asked her a question. "Well," he said, as they descended from their car. "I'm sorry, dear," she answered. "I was daydreaming again. What did you ask?"
"I didn't know that I was that boring,"
Reggie said without humor. He turned dramatically to ensure that she was paying attention. "What choice did you make for dinner tonight?"
"I had narrowed it down to Chinese or Cajun."
At that particular moment, the thought of having dinner with Reggie did not appeal to Francesca.
"I'm very tired tonight," she said. "I think I'll just eat by myself in the room and do a little work afterwards."
She could have predicted the hurt look on his face. She reached up and kissed him lightly on the lips.
"You can come by my room for a nightcap about 10.
Once inside her hotel suite, Francesca's first action was to activate her computer terminal and check for messages. She had 4 altogether. The printed menu told her the originator of each message, the time of its transmission, the duration of the message, and its urgency priority. The urgency priority system was a new innovation of International Communications, Inc., one of the 3 surviving communications companies that were finally flourishing again after massive consolidation during the middle years of the century. A UPS user entered his daily schedule early in the morning and identified what priority messages could interrupt which activities. Francesca had chosen to accept forwarding of only priority 1 acute emergency messages to the terminal at David Brown's house. The taping of David and his family had to be accomplished in 1 day, and she had wanted to minimize the chances of an interruption and delay. The rest of her messages had been retained at the hotel. She had a single priority 2 message, 3 minutes long, from Carlo Bianchi. Francesca frowned, entered the proper codes into the terminal, and turned on the video monitor. A suave, middle-aged Italian, dressed in après-ski clothes,
sitting on a couch with a burning fireplace behind him, came into view. "Buongiorno, cara," he greeted her. After allowing the video camera to pan around the living room at his new villa in Cortina d'Ampezzo, Signor Bianchi came right to the point. Why was she refusing to appear in the advertisements for his summer line of sportswear? His company had offered her an incredible amount of money, and had even tailored the advertising campaign to pick up on the space theme. The spots would not be shown until after the Newton mission would be over, so there was no conflict with her ISA agreements. Carlo acknowledged that they had had some differences in the past, but according to him, they were many years ago. He needed an answer in a week.
"Screw you, Carlo," Francesca thought, surprised at the intensity of her reactions. There were few people in the world who could upset Francesca, but Carlo Bianchi was one of them. She entered the necessary commands to record a message to her agent, Daryl Bowman, in London.
"Hi, Daryl. It's Francesca in Dallas. Tell that weasel Bianchi I wouldn't do his ads even if he offered me 10 million marks. And by the way, since I understand that his main competition these days is Donatelli, why don't you find their advertising director, Gabriella something or other? I met her once in Milano, and let her know that I would be happy to do something for them after Project Newton is over. April or May."
She paused for a moment.
"That's it. Back in Rome tomorrow night. My best to Heather."
Francesca's longest message was from her husband, Alberto, a tall, graying, distinguished executive almost 60 years old. Alberto ran the Italian division of Schmidt and Hagenest, the multimedia German conglomerate that owned, among other things, over 1/3 of the free newspapers and magazines in Europe, as well as the leading commercial television networks in both Germany and Italy. In his transmission, Alberto was sitting in the den in their home, wearing a rich charcoal suit and sipping a brandy. His tone was warm, familiar, but more like a father than a husband. He told Francesca that her long interview with Admiral Otto Heilmann had been on the news throughout Europe that day, that he had enjoyed her comments and insights, as always, but that he had thought Otto came across as an egomaniac. Not surprising, Francesca had mused when she heard her husband's comment, since he absolutely is. But he is often useful to me. Alberto shared some good news about one of his children. Francesca had 3 stepchildren, all of whom were older than she, before telling her that he missed her and was looking forward to seeing her the next night. "Me too," Francesca thought, before responding to his message. "It is comfortable living with you. I have both freedom and security." 4 hours later, Francesca was standing outside on her balcony, smoking a cigarette in the cold Texas December air. She was wrapped tightly in the thick robe supplied to the rooms by the hotel. "At least it's not like California," she thought to herself as she pulled a deep drag into her lungs. "At least in Texas some of the hotels do have smoking balconies. Those zealots in the American West Coast would make smoking a felony if they could." She walked over to the side of the railing so that she would have a better view of a supersonic airliner approaching the airport from the west. In her mind's eye, she was inside the plane, as she would be the next day on her flight home to Rome. She imagined that this particular flight had come from Tokyo, the undisputed economic capital of the world before the great chaos. After being devastated by their lack of raw materials during the lean years in the middle of the century, the Japanese were now prosperous again as the world returned to a free market. Francesca watched the plane land and then looked up at the sky full of stars above her. She took another pull on her cigarette and then followed the exhaled smoke as it drifted slowly away from her into the air. "And so, Francesca," she reflected, "now comes what may be your greatest assignment. A chance to become immortal. At least I should be remembered a long time as one of the Newton crew." Her mind turned to the Newton mission itself, and briefly conjured up images of fantastic creatures who might have created the pair of gargantuan spaceships and sent them to visit the solar system. But her thoughts jumped back quickly to the real world, to the contracts that David Brown had signed just before she had left his home that afternoon. "That makes us partners, my esteemed Dr. Brown. And completes the first phase of my plan. And unless I miss my guess, that was a gleam of interest in your eyes today." Francesca had given David a perfunctory kiss when they had finished discussing and signing the contracts. They had been alone together in his study. For a moment she had thought he was going to return the kiss with a more meaningful one. Francesca finished her cigarette, stubbed it out in the ashtray, and went back into her hotel room. As soon as she opened the door, she could hear the sound of heavy breathing. The oversized bed was in disarray, and a naked Reggie Wilson was lying across it on his back, his regular snores disturbing the silence of the suite. "You have great equipment, my friend," she commented silently, "both for life and for lovemaking. But neither is an athletic contest. You would be more interesting if there was some subtlety, perhaps even a little finesse." Chapter 7 Public Relations. The solitary eagle soared high above the marshes in the early morning light. It banked on a gust of wind coming from the ocean and turned north along the coast. Far below the eagle, starting at the light brown and white sands beside the ocean and continuing through the collection of islands and rivers and bays that stretched for miles toward the western horizon, an intermittent complex of diverse buildings connected by paved roads broke up the grassland and swamp. 75 years earlier, the Kennedy spaceport had been one of a half dozen locations on the Earth where travelers could disembark from their high-speed trains and airplanes to catch a shuttle flight up to one of the LEO, Low Earth Orbit, space stations. But the great chaos had changed the spaceport into a ghostly reminder of a once flourishing culture. Its portals and fancy connecting passageways were abandoned for years to the grasses, water birds, alligators, and ubiquitous insects of central Florida. In the 2160s, after 20 years of complete atrophy, the reactivation of the spaceport had begun. It had been used first as an airport, and then had evolved again into a general transportation center serving the Florida Atlantic coast. When launches to space recommenced in the mid-2170s, it was natural that the old Kennedy launch pads would be recommissioned. By December of 2199, more than half of the old spaceport had been refurbished to handle the steadily growing traffic between Earth and space. From one of the windows of his temporary office, Valery Bortsov watched the magnificent eagle glide gracefully back to its nest, high in one of the few tall trees within the center. He loved birds. He had been fascinated by them for years, beginning in his early boyhood in China. In his most vivid recurring dream, General Bortsov was always living on an amazing planet where the skies swarmed with flying creatures. He could still remember asking his father if there had been any flying biots inside the first Rama spacecraft, and then being acutely disappointed with the reply. General Bortsov heard the sound of a large transport vehicle and looked out his west-facing window. The propulsion module that would be used by both Newton vehicles was emerging from its test complex, on a huge platform moving on multiple tracks. The repaired module, sent back to the subsystem test area because of a problem with its ion controller, would be placed that afternoon inside a cargo shuttle and transferred to the spacecraft assembly facility at Space Station LEO-2, where it would be retrofitted prior to the final integrated vehicle tests just before Christmas. Both of the two Newton flight spacecraft were currently undergoing final checkout and test at LEO-2. All of the simulation exercises for the cosmonauts, however, were conducted over at LEO-3 with the backup equipment. The cosmonauts would only use the actual flight systems at LEO-2 during the last week before launch. On the south side of the building, an electric bus pulled to a stop outside the office complex and discharged a small handful of people. One of the passengers was a blonde woman wearing a long-sleeved yellow blouse, with vertical black stripes and a pair of black silk pants. She walked with an effortless grace over to the building entrance. General Bortsov admired her from a distance, reminding himself that Francesca had been a successful model before becoming a television journalist. He wondered what it was that she wanted, and why she had insisted on seeing him privately before the medical briefing this morning. A minute later he greeted her at the door to his office. "Good morning, Signora Sabatini," he said.
"Still so formal, General," she replied, laughing.
"Even when there's only the two of us? You and the two Japanese men are the only members of the team who refuse to call me Francesca." She noticed that he was staring strangely at her. She looked down at her clothing to see if something was wrong.
"What's the matter?"
she asked him after a momentary hesitation. "It must be your blouse," General Bortsov answered with a start.
"For just a moment I had the distinct impression that you were a tiger, poised to pounce on a hapless antelope or gazelle. Maybe it's old age. Or my mind has started playing tricks on me."
He invited her to come into his office.
I have had men tell me before that I resemble a cat, but never a tiger.
Francesca sat down in the chair beside the general's desk. She meowed with a mischievous smile.
I'm just a harmless tabby house cat.
I don't believe that for a moment, Botsov said with a chuckle.
Many adjectives can be used to describe you, Francesca, but harmless would never be one of them.
He suddenly became very businesslike.
Now, what can I do for you?
You said that you had something very important to discuss with me that absolutely could not wait.
Francesca pulled a large sheet of paper out of her soft briefcase and handed it to General Bortsov.
This is the press schedule for the project, she said. I reviewed it in detail only yesterday with both the Public Information Office and the World Television Networks. Notice that of the in-depth personal interviews with the cosmonauts, only 5 have already been completed. 4 more were originally scheduled for this month.
But notice also that when you added that extra 3-day simulation to this coming set of exercises, you wiped out the time that had been allotted to interview Wakefield and Turgenev.
She paused for a moment to make sure he was following her.
We can still catch Takagishi next Saturday, and we'll tape the O'Tooles on Christmas Eve in Boston. But both Richard and Irina say that they now have no time for their interviews. In addition, we still have an old problem. Neither you nor Nicole is scheduled at all.
You insisted on a meeting at 7:30 this morning to discuss this press schedule?
Botsov interrupted, his voice clearly conveying the relative importance that he assigned to such activities.
Among other things, Francesca answered nonchalantly.
She ignored the implied criticism in his comment.
Of the people on this mission, she continued, the polls show that the public has the greatest interest in you, me, Nicole Desjardins, and David Brown. So far, I have been unable to pin you down on a date for your personal interview, and Madame Desjardins says that she does not intend to have one at all. The networks are unhappy. My pre-launch coverage is going to be incomplete. I need some help from you.
Francesca looked directly at General Bortsov.
I am asking you to cancel the additional simulation, to set a definite time for your personal interview, and to talk to Nicole on my behalf.
He frowned. The general was both angered and annoyed by Francesca's presumption. He was going to tell her that the scheduling of personal publicity interviews was not high on his priority list. But something held him back. Both his sixth sense and a lifetime of experience in dealing with people told him to hesitate, that there was more to this discussion than he had yet heard. He temporized by changing the subject.
Incidentally, I must tell you that I am growing increasingly concerned about the lavish scope of this New Year's Eve party that your friends in the Italian government business coalition are hosting. I know we agreed at the beginning of our training that we would participate as a group in that one social function. But I had no idea that it was going to be billed as the Party of the Century, as it was called last week by one of those American personality magazines. You know all those people. Can't you do something to downplay the party?
The gala was another item on my agenda,
Francesca replied, carefully avoiding the thrust of his comment.
I need your assistance there as well. 4 of the Newton cosmonauts now say they do not plan to attend, and 2 or 3 more have suggested that they may have other commitments, even though we all agreed to the party back in March. Takagishi and Yamanaka want to celebrate the holiday with their families in Japan, and Richard Wakefield tells me that he has made reservations to go scuba diving in the Cayman Islands. And then, there's that French woman again, who simply says that she's not coming and refuses to offer any kind of explanation.
Bortsov could not suppress a grin.
Why are you having such a hard time with Nicole Desjardins? I would think that since both of you are women, you would be able to speak to her more easily than the others.
She is entirely unsympathetic with the role of the press in this mission. She has told me so several times, and she is very stubborn about her privacy.
Francesca shrugged her shoulders.
But the public is absolutely fascinated with her. After all, not only is she a doctor and a linguist and a former Olympic champion, but also she is the daughter of a famous novelist and the mother of a 14-year-old daughter, despite never having been married.
Valery Bortsov was looking at his watch.
Just for my information, he interrupted. How many more items are on your agenda, as you call it? They are due in the auditorium in 10 more minutes.
He smiled back at Francesca,
and I feel compelled to remind you that Madame Desjardins went out of her way today to accommodate your request for press coverage of this briefing.
Francesca studied General Bortsov for several seconds.
I think he's ready now, she thought to herself, and unless I misjudged him, he will understand immediately.
She pulled a small cubic object out of her briefcase and handed it across the desk.
This is the only other item on my agenda, she said.
The Newton commander-in-chief seemed puzzled. He turned the cube over in his hands.
A freelance journalist sold it to us,
Francesca said in a very serious tone. We were assured it was the only copy in existence. She paused a moment while Bortsov loaded the cube into the appropriate part of his desk computer. He blanched noticeably when the first video segment from the cube appeared on the monitor. He watched the wild rantings of his daughter, Natasha, for about 15 seconds.
I wanted to keep this out of the hands of the tabloid press, Francesca added softly.
How long is the tape? General Bortsov asked quietly.
Almost half an hour, she replied.
I'm the only one who has seen the entire thing.
General Bortsov heaved a sigh. This was the moment his wife, Petra, had dreaded, ever since it was first made official that he would be the commanding officer of the Newton. The institute director at Sverdlovsk had promised that no reporters would have access to his daughter. Now, here was a videotape with a 30-minute interview with her. Petra would be mortified. He stared out the window. In his mind, he was assessing what would happen to the mission if his daughter's acute schizophrenia were paraded before the public. It would be embarrassing, he conceded, but the mission would not be damaged in any serious way. General Bortsov looked across at Francesca. He hated making deals, and he wasn't certain that Francesca herself had not commissioned the interview with Natasha. Nevertheless, Bortsov relaxed and forced a smile.
I guess I could thank you, he said. But somehow it doesn't seem appropriate.
He paused for a moment.
I assume I'm expected to show some gratitude.
So far so good, Francesca thought. She knew better than to say anything just yet.
All right, the general continued after the lengthy silence. I will cancel the extra simulation. Others have already complained about it.
He turned the data cube over in his hands.
And Petra and I will come to Rome early, as you once suggested, for the personal interview. I will remind all the cosmonauts tomorrow about the party on New Year's Eve, and tell them that it is their duty to attend. But neither I nor anyone else can require Nicole Desjardins to talk to you about anything except her work.
He stood up abruptly.
Now it's time for us to go to that biometry meeting.
Francesca reached up and kissed him on the cheek.
Thank you, Valeri, she said.
Chapter 8 Biometry. The medical briefing had already begun when Francesca and General Bortsov arrived. All the rest of the cosmonauts were present, as well as 25 or 30 additional engineers and scientists associated with the mission. 4 newspaper reporters and a television crew completed the audience. At the front of the small auditorium stood Nicole Desjardins, wearing her grey flight outfit as always, and holding a laser pointer in her hand. To the side of her was a tall Japanese man in a blue dress suit. He was listening carefully to a question from the audience. Nicole interrupted him to acknowledge the new arrivals.
Sumimasen, Akumatsu-san, she said. Let me introduce our commander, General Valery Bortsov of the Soviet Union, as well as the journalist cosmonaut Francesca Sabatini.
She turned toward the latecomers.
Dobre utra,
Nicole said to the general, quickly nodding a greeting in Francesca's direction as well.
This is the esteemed Dr. Toshiro Hakamatsu, Nicole said. He designed and developed the biometry system that we are going to use in flight, including the tiny probes that will be inserted into our bodies.
General Bortsov extended his hand.
I am glad to meet you, Hakamatsu-san, he said. Madame Desjardins has made us all very much aware of your outstanding work.
Thank you,
the man replied, bowing in the direction of Bortsov after shaking his hand.
It is an honor for me to be part of this project.
Francesca and General Bortsov took the 2 empty seats at the front of the auditorium, and the meeting continued. Nicole aimed her pointer at a keyboard on the side of a small podium, and a full-scale, multicolored male model of the human cardiovascular system, with veins marked in blue and arteries in red, appeared, as a three-dimensional holographic image in the front of the room. Tiny white markers circulating inside the flowing blood vessels indicated the direction and rate of flow. The Life Sciences Board of the ISA just last week gave final approval to the new Hakimatsu probes as our key health monitoring system for the mission, Nicole was saying. They withheld their approval until the last minute so that they could properly assess the results of the stress testing, in which the new probes were asked to perform in a wide variety of off-nominal situations. Even under those conditions, there was no sign that any rejection mechanisms were triggered in any of the test subjects. We are fortunate that we will be able to use this system, for it will make life much easier both for me, as your life science officer, and for you. During the mission, you will not be subjected to the routine injection scanning techniques that have been used on previous projects. These new probes are injected one time, maybe twice at the most, during our 100-day mission, and they do not need to be replaced.
How did the long-term rejection problem get solved? Came a question from another doctor in the audience, interrupting Nicole's train of thought.
I will discuss that in detail during our splinter session this afternoon, she replied. For now, it should be sufficient for me to mention that since the key chemistry governing rejection focuses on four or five critical parameters, including acidity, the probes are coated with chemicals that adapt to the local chemistry at the implantation site. In other words, once the probe arrives at its destination, it non-invasively samples its ambient biochemical environment and then exudes a thin coating for itself that is designed to be consistent with the chemistry of the host and thereby avoid rejection. But I am getting ahead of myself, Nicole said, turning to face the large model showing blood circulation in the human being. The family of probes will be inserted here, in the left arm, and the individual monitors will disperse according to their prescribed guidance programs to 32 distinct locales in the body. There they will embed themselves in the host tissue.
The inside of the holographic model became animated as she spoke, and the audience watched as 32 blinking lights started from the left arm and scattered throughout the body. Four went to the brain, three more to the heart, four to the primary glands of the endocrine system, and the remaining 21 monitors spread out to assorted locations and organs, ranging from the eyes to the fingers and toes.
Each of the individual probes contains both an array of microscopic sensors to sample important health parameters, and a fancy data system that first stores and then transmits the recorded information upon receipt of an enabling command from the scanner. In practice, I would expect to scan each of you and dump all your health telemetry once a day, but the recorders can handle data covering up to 4 days if necessary. Nicole stopped and looked at the audience. Are there any questions so far? She asked.
Yes, said Richard Wakefield in the front row. I see how this system gathers trillions of bits of data, but that's the easy part. There's no way you or any other human being could look at all that information. How does the data get synthesized or analyzed so that you can tell if anything irregular is happening?
You'd make a great straight man, Richard, Nicole said with a smile. That's my next subject.
She held up a small, flat, thin object with a keyboard on it.
This is a standard programmable scanner that permits the monitored information to be sampled in many different ways. I can call for a full dump from any and or all channels, or I can request transmission only of warning data.
Nicole saw many confused looks in her audience.
I'd better back up and start this part of the explanation again, she said. Each measurement made by each instrument has an expected range, one that will vary, of course, from individual to individual, and a much wider tolerance range used to identify a true emergency. If a particular measurement only exceeds the expected range, it is entered in the warning file and that specific channel is marked with an alarm identifier. One of my options using the scanner is to read out only these warning lists. If an individual cosmonaut is feeling fine, my normal procedure would be just to see if there are any entries in the warning buffer.
But if you have a measurement outside the tolerance range, interjected Janos Tabori, who was the backup life science officer, then watch out. The monitor turns on its emergency transmitter and uses all its internal power to send out a beep, beep noise that is frightening. I know, it happened to me during a short test with what turned out to be improper tolerance values. I thought I was dying.
His comment caused general laughter.
The image of little Janos walking around emitting a high-pitched beep was amusing.
No system is foolproof, Nicole continued, and this one is only as good as the set of values that are entered to trigger both the warnings and the emergencies. So, you can see why calibration data is essential. We have examined each of your medical histories with extreme care and entered initial values in the monitors. But we must see actual results with the real probes inserted in your bodies. That's the reason for today's activity. We will insert your probe set today, monitor your performance during the 4 final simulation exercises that begin on Thursday, and then update the trigger values, if necessary, before we actually launch.
There was some involuntary squirming as the cosmonauts thought about the prospect of tiny medical laboratories indefinitely embedded in their critical organs. They were accustomed to the regular investigative probes that were placed in the body to obtain some specific information, like the amount of plaque blocking the arteries, but those probes were temporary. The thought of permanent electronic invasion was, to say the least, disquieting. General Michael O'Toole asked 2 questions that were bothering most of the crew.
Nicole, he inquired in his usual earnest manner, can you tell us how you make sure that the probes actually go to the right places? Even more important, what happens if one malfunctions?
Of course, Michael, she answered pleasantly.
Remember, these things will be inside me as well, and I had to ask the same questions.
Nicole Desjardins was in her middle 30s. Her skin was a shiny copper brown, her eyes dark brown and almond-shaped, her hair a luxurious jet black. There was an unshakable self-confidence radiating from her that was sometimes mistaken for arrogance.
You won't leave the clinic today until we have verified that all the probes are properly positioned, she was saying. Based on recent past experience, 1 or 2 of you may have a monitor wander off course. It is an easy matter to track it with the lab equipment and then send override commands as necessary to move it to the proper spot. As far as the malfunction issue is concerned, there are several levels of fault protection. First, each specific monitor tests its own battery of sensors more than 20 times a day. Any individual instrument failing a test is turned off immediately by the executive software in its own monitor. In addition, each of the probe packages undergoes a full and rigorous self-test twice a day. Failure of self-test is one of many fault conditions that causes the monitor to secrete chemicals causing self-destruction, with eventual harmless absorption by the body. Lest you become unduly concerned, we have rigorously verified all these fault paths with test subjects during the past year.
Nicole wound up her presentation and stood quietly in front of her colleagues.
Any more questions? She asked.
After a few seconds' hesitation, she continued.
Then I need a volunteer to walk up here beside the robot nurse and be inoculated. My personal probe set was injected and verified last week. Who wants to be next?
Francesca stood up.
All right. We'll start with la bella signora Sabatini,
Nicole said. She gestured to the television personnel.
Focus those cameras on the tracer simulation. It's quite a show when these electronic bugs swarm through the bloodstream.
Chapter 9. Diastolic Irregularity. Through the window, Nicole could barely discern the Siberian snowfields in the oblique December light. They were more than 50,000 feet below her. The supersonic plane was slowing now as it moved south towards Vladivostok and the islands of Japan. Nicole yawned. After only 3 hours of sleep, it would be a fight all day to keep her body awake. It was almost 10 in the morning in Japan, but back home at Beauvoir, in the Loire Valley not far from Tours, her daughter, Genevieve, still had 4 more hours of sleep until her alarm would awaken her at 7 o'clock. The video monitor in the back of the seat in front of Nicole automatically turned on and reminded her that in only 15 minutes the plane would land at the Kansai Transportation Center. The lovely Japanese girl on the screen suggested that now would be an excellent time to make or confirm ground transportation and housing arrangements. Nicole activated the communication system in her seat, and a thin rectangular tray with a keyboard and small display area slid in front of her. In less than a minute, Nicole arranged both her train ride to Kyoto and her electric trolley passage from there to her hotel. She used her universal credit card to pay for all transactions, after first correctly identifying herself by indicating that her mother's maiden name was Anawi Tiaso. When she was finished, a small printed schedule listing her train and trolley identifiers, along with the times of arrival and transit, she would reach her hotel at 11:14 a.m. Japanese time, popped out of one end of the tray. As the plane prepared for its landing, Nicole thought about the reason for her sudden trip, one-third of the way around the world. Just 24 hours ago, she had been planning to spend this day around her home, alternating some office work in the morning with some language practice for Genevieve in the afternoon. It was the beginning of the holiday break for the cosmonauts, and, except for that stupid party in Rome at the end of the year, Nicole was supposedly free until she had to report to LEO-3 on January the 8th. But while she had been sitting in her office at home the previous morning, routinely checking the biometry from the final set of simulations, Nicole had come across a curious phenomenon. She had been studying Richard Wakefield's heart and blood pressure during a variable gravity test, and had not understood a particularly rapid surge in his pulse rate. She had then decided to check Dr. Takagishi's detailed heart biometry for comparison, since he had been engaged in a strenuous physical activity with Richard at the time of the pulse surge. What she had found, when she had examined a full dump of Takagishi's heart information, had been an even bigger surprise. The Japanese professor's diastolic expansion was decidedly irregular, maybe even pathological. But no warnings had been issued by the probe, and no data channels had been alarmed. What was going on? Had she detected a malfunction in the Hakamatsu system? An hour's worth of detective work had resulted in the identification of more peculiarities. During the full set of simulations, there had been 4 separate intervals during which Takagishi's problem had occurred. The abnormal behavior was sporadic and intermittent. Sometimes, the extra-long diastole, reminiscent of a valve problem during the filling of the heart with blood, would not appear for as long as 38 hours. However, the fact that it did recur 4 different times suggested that there was definitely an abnormality of some kind. What had mystified Nicole was not the raw data itself, it was the failure of the system to trigger the proper alarms in the presence of the wildly irregular observations. As part of her analysis, she had traced laboriously through the Takagishi medical history, paying special attention to the cardiology report. She had found no hint of any kind of abnormality, so had convinced herself that she was seeing a sensor error and not a true medical problem. So, if the system was working correctly, she had reasoned, the onset of the long diastole should have immediately sent the heart monitor outside the expected range and triggered an alarm. But it didn't. Neither the first time nor any other time. Is it possible that we have a double failure here? If so, how did the unit continue to pass self-test? At first, Nicole had thought about phoning one of her assistants in the life science office at ISA to discuss the anomaly she had found. But she decided instead, since it was a holiday for ISA, to telephone Dr. Hakamatsu in Japan. That phone call to him had completely bewildered her. He had told her flatly that the phenomenon she had observed must have been in the patient, that no combination of component failures in his probe could have produced such strange results.
"But then why were there no entries in the warning file?"
she had asked the Japanese electronics designer.
"Because no expected range values were exceeded," he answered confidently. "For some reason, an extremely wide expected range must have been entered for this particular cosmonaut. Have you looked at his medical history?"
Later on in the conversation, when Nicole told Dr. Hakamatsu that the unexplained data had actually come from the probes inside one of his countrymen, namely cosmonaut scientist Takagishi, the usually restrained engineer had actually shouted into the phone.
"Wonderful," he had said. "Then I'll be able to clear up this mystery in a hurry. I'll contact Takagishi-san over at Kyoto University and let you know what I find."
3 hours later, Nicole's video monitor had revealed the somber face of Dr. Shigeru Takagishi.
"Madame de Jardin," he had said very politely,
"I understand that you have been talking with my colleague, Hakamatsu-san, about my biometry output during the simulations. Would you be kind enough to explain to me what you have found?"
Nicole had then presented all the information to her fellow cosmonaut, concealing nothing and expressing her personal belief that the source of the erroneous data had indeed been a probe malfunction. A long silence followed Nicole's explanation. At length, the worried Japanese scientist had spoken again.
"Hakamatsu-san just visited me here at the university and checked out the probe set inside me. He will report that he found no problems with his electronics.
Akagishi had then paused, seemingly deep in thought.
Madame de Jardin,
he had said a few seconds later,
I would like to ask you a favor. It is a matter of the utmost importance to me. Could you possibly come to see me in Japan in the very near future? I would like to talk with you personally and explain something that may be related to my irregular biometry data.
There had been an earnestness in Takagishi's face that Nicole could neither overlook nor misinterpret. He was clearly imploring her to help him. Without asking any more questions, she had agreed to visit him immediately. A few minutes later, she had reserved a seat on the overnight supersonic flight from Paris to Osaka.
It was never bombed during the Great War with America,
Takagishi said, waving his arms at the city of Kyoto, spread out below them.
And it suffered almost no damage when the hoodlums took over for 7 months in 2141. I admit that I am prejudiced, he said, smiling. But to me, Kyoto is the most beautiful city in the world.
Many of my countrymen feel that way about Paris,
Nicole answered. She pulled her coat tightly around her. The air was cold and damp. It felt as if it might snow at any moment. She was wondering when her associate was going to start talking about their business. She had not flown 5,000 miles for a tour of the city, although she did admit that this Kiyomizu temple, set among the trees on a hillside overlooking the city, was certainly a magnificent spot.
Let's have some tea,
Takagishi said. He led her to one of the several outside tea rooms flanking the main part of the old Buddhist temple. Now, Nicole said to herself, as she stifled a yawn, he's going to tell me what this is all about. Takagishi had met her at the hotel when she had arrived. He had suggested that she have some lunch and a short nap before he returned. After he had picked her up at 3 o'clock, they had come directly to this temple. He poured the thick Japanese tea into the two cups and waited for Nicole to take a sip. The hot liquid warmed her mouth, even though she didn't care for the bitter taste.
Madame,
Takagishi began.
You are doubtless wondering why I have asked you to come all the way to Japan on such short notice. You see,
he spoke slowly, but with great intensity.
All my life, I have dreamt that perhaps another Rama spacecraft would return while I was still alive. During my studies at the university and during my many years of research, I was preparing myself for one single event. The return of the Ramans. On that March morning in 2197, when Alistair Moore called me to say that the latest images from Excalibur indicated that we had another extraterrestrial visitor, I nearly wept with joy. I knew immediately that the ISA would mount a mission to visit the spaceship. I resolved to be part of that mission.
The Japanese scientist took a drink from his tea and looked to his left, out across the manicured green trees and the slopes above the city.
When I was a boy,
he continued, his careful English barely audible,
I would climb these hills on a clear night and stare into the sky, searching for the home of the special intelligence that had created that incomparable giant machine. Once I came with my father and we huddled together in the cold night air, looking at the stars, while he told me what it had been like in his village during the days of the first Rama encounter, 12 years before I was born. I believed on that night.
He turned to look at Nicole, and she could again see the passion in his eyes.
And I still believe today that there was some reason for that visit, some purpose for the appearance of that awesome spaceship. I have studied all the data from that first encounter, hoping to find a clue that would explain why it came. Nothing has been conclusive. I have developed several theories on the subject, but I do not have enough evidence to support any of them.
Again, Takagishi stopped talking to drink some of his tea. Nicole had been both surprised and impressed by the depth of feeling he had exhibited. She sat patiently and said nothing while she waited for him to continue.
I knew that I had a good chance to be selected as a cosmonaut, he said. Not only because of my publications, including the Atlas, but also because one of my closest associates, Hisanori Akita, was the Japanese representative on the selection board. When the number of scientists remaining in the competition had been reduced to 8, and I was one of them, Akita-san suggested to me that it looked as if the 2 leading contenders were myself and David Brown. You'll recall that up until that time, no physical examinations of any kind had been conducted.
That's right, Nicole remembered. The potential crew was first reduced to 48, and then we were all taken to Heidelberg for the physicals. The German doctors in charge insisted that each of the candidates must pass every single medical criterion. The academy graduates were the first group tested, and 5 out of 20 failed, including Alain Blamont.
When your countryman Blamont, who had already flown 6 major missions for the ISA, was disqualified from consideration because of that trivial heart murmur, and the Cosmonaut Selection Board subsequently upheld the doctors by denying his appeal, I completely panicked.
The proud Japanese physicist was now staring directly into Nicole's eyes, entreating her to understand.
I was afraid that I was going to lose the most important opportunity of my career because of a minor physical problem that had never before affected any part of my life.
He paused to choose his words carefully.
I know that what I did was wrong and dishonorable, but I convinced myself at the time it was all right, that my chance to decipher the greatest puzzle in man's history should not be blocked by a group of small-minded doctors defining acceptable health only in terms of numerical values.
Dr. Takagishi told the rest of his story without embellishment or obvious emotion. The passion he had fleetingly demonstrated during his discussion of the Ramans had vanished. His monotonic recital was crisp and clear. He explained how he had cajoled his family physician into falsifying his medical history and providing him with a new drug that would prevent the occurrence of his diastolic irregularity during the 2 days of his physical at Heidelberg. Although there had been some risk of deleterious side effects from the new drug, everything went according to plan. Takagishi passed the rigorous physical and was ultimately selected as one of the 2 mission scientists, along with Dr. David Brown. He had never thought again about the medical issue until about 3 months ago, when Nicole had first explained to the cosmonauts that she was planning to recommend the usage of the Hakamatsu probe system during the mission instead of the standard temporary probe scans once every week.
You'll see,
Takagishi explained, his brow now starting to furrow.
Under the old mission technique, I could have used that same drug once a week, and neither you nor any other life science officer would ever have seen my irregularity. But a permanent monitoring system cannot be fooled. The drug is much too dangerous for constant use.
So you somehow worked out a deal with Hakamatsu, Nicole thought, jumping ahead of him in her own mind, either with or without his explicit knowledge. And you input expected value ranges that would not trigger in the presence of your abnormality. You hoped that nobody analyzing the tests would call for a full biometry dump. Now she understood why he had summoned her urgently to Japan. And you want me to keep your secret.
Watakuski no doryo wa wakarimasu,
Nicole said kindly, changing into Japanese to show her sympathy for her colleague's anguish.
I can tell how much distress this is causing you. You need not explain in detail how you tampered with the Hakamatsu probes.
She paused and watched his face relax.
But, if I understand you correctly, what you want is for me to become an accomplice to your deception. You recognize, of course, that I cannot even consider preserving your secret unless I am absolutely convinced that your minor physical problem, as you call it, represents no possible threat to the mission. Otherwise, I will be forced.
Madame Tejada,
Takagishi interrupted her.
I have the utmost respect for your integrity. I would never, never ask you to keep my heart irregularity out of the record unless you agree that it was really an insignificant problem.
He looked at her in silence for several seconds.
When Hakamatsu first phoned me last evening, he continued quietly, I thought originally that I would call a press conference and then resign from the project. But while I was thinking about what I would say in my resignation, I kept seeing this image of Professor Brown. He is a brilliant man, my American counterpart, but he is also, in my opinion, too certain of his own infallibility. The most likely replacement for me would be Professor Wolfgang Heinrich from Bonn. He has published many fine papers about Rama, but he, like Brown, believes that these celestial visits represent random events, totally without connection in any way to us and our planet.
The intensity and passion had returned to his eyes.
I cannot quit now, unless I have no choice. Both Brown and Heinrich might miss the clue.
Behind Takagishi, on the path that led back to the main wooden building of the temple, three Buddhist monks walked briskly past. Despite the cold, they were dressed lightly in their usual charcoal-gray smocks, their feet exposed to the cold in open sandals. The Japanese scientist was proposing to Nicole that they spend the rest of the day at the office of his personal physician, where they could study his complete and uncensored medical history, dating back to his childhood. If she would be willing, he added, they would give her a data cube containing all the information to take back to France and study at her leisure. Nicole, who had been listening intently to Takagishi for almost an hour, momentarily diverted her attention to the three monks now purposely climbing the stairs in the distance. Their eyes are so serene, she thought. Their lives so free of contradiction. One-mindedness can be a virtue. It makes all the answers easy. For just a moment, she was envious of the monks and their ordered existence. She wondered how well they would handle the dilemma that Dr. Takagishi was presenting her. He is not one of the space cadets, she was now thinking, so his role is not absolutely critical to mission success. And in a sense, he is right. The doctors on the project have been too strict. They never should have disqualified Alain. It would be a shame if...
Dajobo, she said before he had finished talking. I will go with you to see your doctor, and if I don't find anything that bothers me, I will take the entire file home with me to study during the holidays.
Takagishi's face lit up.
But let me warn you again, she added, if there is anything in your history that I find questionable, or if I have the slightest shred of evidence that you have withheld any information from me, then I will ask you to resign immediately.
Thank you. Thank you so much,
Dr. Takagishi replied, standing and bowing to his female colleague.
Thank you so much, he repeated.
Chapter 10 The Cosmonaut and the Pope. General O'Toole could not have slept more than 2 hours altogether. The combination of excitement and jet lag had kept his mind active all night long. He had studied the lovely bucolic mural on the wall opposite the bed in his hotel room and counted all the animals twice. Unfortunately, he had remained wide awake after he had finished both counts. He took a deep breath, hoping that it would help him relax. So, why all this nervousness? He thought. He is just a man, like all the rest on Earth. Well, not exactly. O'Toole sat up straight in his chair and smiled. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and he was sitting in a small anteroom inside the Vatican. He was about to have a private audience with the Vicar of Christ himself, Pope John Paul V. During his childhood, Michael O'Toole had often dreamed of some day becoming the first North American Pope. Pope Michael, he had called himself during the long Sunday afternoons when he had studied his catechism alone. As he had repeated the words of his lessons over and over and committed them to memory, he had imagined himself, maybe 50 years in the future, wearing the cassock and papal ring, celebrating Mass for thousands in the great churches and stadia of the world. He would inspire the poor, the hopeless, the downtrodden. He would show them how God could lead them to a better life. As a young man, Michael O'Toole had loved all learning, but three subjects had especially intrigued him. He could not read enough about religion, history, and physics. Somehow, his facile mind found it easy to jump between these different disciplines. It never bothered him that the epistemologies of religion and physics were 180 degrees apart. Michael O'Toole had no difficulty recognizing which questions in life should be answered by physics and which ones by religion. All three of his favorite scholastic subjects merged in the study of creation. It was, after all, the beginning of everything, including religion, history, and physics. How had it happened? Was God present, as the referee, perhaps, for the kickoff of the universe 18 billion years ago? Wasn't it he who had provided the impetus for the cataclysmic explosion known as the Big Bang that produced all matter out of energy? Hadn't he foreseen that those original pristine hydrogen atoms would coalesce into giant clouds of gas and then collapse under gravitation to become the stars in which would be manufactured the basic chemical building blocks of life? And I have never lost my fascination for creation, O'Toole said to himself, as he waited for his papal audience. How did it all happen? What is the significance of the particular sequence of events? He remembered his questions of the priests when he was a teenager. I probably decided not to become a priest, because it would have limited my free access to scientific truth. The church has never been as comfortable as I am with the apparent incompatibilities between God and Einstein. An American priest from the Vatican State Department had been waiting at his hotel in Rome the previous evening, when O'Toole had returned from his day as a tourist. The priest had introduced himself and apologized profusely for not having responded to the letter that General O'Toole had written from Boston in November. It would have facilitated the process, the priest had remarked in passing, if the general had pointed out in his letter that he was the General O'Toole, the Newton cosmonaut. Nevertheless, the priest had continued, the papal schedule had been juggled, and the Holy Father would be delighted to see O'Toole the next morning. As the door to the papal office swung open, the American general instinctively stood up. The priest from the night before walked into the room, looking very nervous, and quickly shook O'Toole's hand. They both glanced towards the doorway, where the Pope, wearing his normal white cassock, was concluding a conversation with a member of his staff. John Paul V came forward into the anteroom, a pleasant smile on his face, and extended his hand toward O'Toole. The cosmonaut automatically dropped to one knee and kissed the papal ring.
"Holy Father," he murmured,
astonished at the excited pounding of his heart.
"Thank you for seeing me. This is indeed a great honor for me."
"For me as well,"
the Pope replied in lightly accented English.
"They have been following the activities of you and your colleagues with great interest."
He gestured towards O'Toole, and the American general followed the church leader into a grand office with high ceilings. A very large, dark wood desk stood on one side of the room, under a life-size portrait of John Paul IV, the man who had become Pope during the darkest days of the Great Chaos, and had provided both the world and the church with 20 years of energetic and inspirational leadership. The gifted Venezuelan, a poet and historical scholar in his own right, had demonstrated to the world between 2139 and 2158 how positive a force the organized church could be at a time when virtually every other institution was collapsing and was, therefore, unable to give any succor to the bewildered masses. The Pope sat down on a couch and motioned for O'Toole to sit next to him. The American priest left the room. In front of O'Toole and the Pope were great windows that opened onto a balcony overlooking the Vatican Gardens some 20 feet below. In the distance, O'Toole could see the Vatican Museum, where he had spent the previous afternoon.
"You wrote in your letter,"
the Holy Father said, without referring to any notes,
"that there were some theological issues that you would like to discuss with me. I assume these are in some way related to your mission."
O'Toole looked at the 70-year-old Spaniard who was the spiritual leader of 1 billion Catholics. The Pope's skin was olive, his features sharp, his thick black hair now mostly grey. His brown eyes were soft and clear. "He certainly doesn't waste any time," O'Toole thought, recalling an article in a Catholic magazine in which one of the leading cardinals in the Vatican administration had praised John Paul V for his management efficiency.
"Yes, Holy Father," O'Toole said. "As you know, I am about to embark on a journey of the utmost significance for humankind. As a Catholic, I have some questions that I thought it might be helpful for me to discuss with you."
He paused for a moment.
"I certainly don't expect you to have all the answers, but maybe you can guide me a little with your accumulated wisdom."
The Pope nodded and waited for O'Toole to continue. The cosmonaut took a deep breath.
"The issue of redemption is one that's bothering me, even though I guess it's just a part of a bigger concern that I have in reconciling the Ramans with our faith."
The Pope's brow furrowed, and O'Toole could tell that he was not communicating very well.
"I have no trouble whatsoever," the general added as an explanation, "with the concept of God creating the Ramans. That's easy to comprehend. But did the Ramans follow a similar pattern of spiritual evolution and therefore need to be redeemed at some point in their history, like human beings on Earth? And if so, did God send Jesus, or perhaps his Raman equivalent, to save them from their sins? Do we humans thus represent an evolutionary paradigm that has been repeated over and over throughout the universe?"
The Pope's smile broadened almost into a grin.
"Goodness, General,"
he said with humor,
"you have romped over a vast intellectual territory very quickly. You must know that I do not have fast answers to such profound questions. The Church has had its scholars addressing the issues raised by Rama for almost 70 years, and, as you would expect, our research has recently intensified because of the discovery of the second spacecraft.
But what do you personally believe, Your Holiness? O'Toole persisted. Did the creatures who made these two incredible space vehicles commit some original sin, and also need a savior sometime in their history? Is the story of Jesus unique for us here on Earth, or is it just one small chapter in a book of nearly infinite length that covers all sentient beings and a general requirement for redemption to achieve salvation?
I'm not certain, the Holy Father replied after several seconds. Sometimes it is nearly impossible for me to fathom the existence of other intelligence in any form out there in the rest of the universe. Then, as soon as I acknowledge that it certainly wouldn't look like us, I struggle with images and pictures that sidetrack my thinking from the kinds of theological questions that you have raised this morning.
He paused for a moment, reflecting.
But most of the time, I imagine that the Ramans too had lessons to learn in the beginning. That God did not create them perfect either, and that at some time in their development he must have sent them Jesus.
The Pope interrupted himself and looked intently at General O'Toole.
Yes,
he continued softly.
I said Jesus. You asked me what I believed personally.